This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Actually, I was struck by quite a few things that came through there, and we're going to be delving more deeply into it. But you were talking about unclogging arteries. How are you unclogging the neural pathways? Because what we've been hearing continuously over the last day or so is that it's pretty obvious what's wrong with the country, but we've got blockages in thinking, blockages in addressing it. How do you do that? You sit in a meeting, you've got a bunch of cadres around you, they've been told to think a particular way. Have you got any tricks that you can tell us that you actually say, hang on, guys, but there is a different way of looking at it?
So what I've learned working with the ANC is that your choice of language is very important. If you choose what we would consider common lexicon, they would dismiss as neoliberalism. And so there you go again on your right-wing tangents. So if you you can say the exact same thing just by co-opting the kind of right language. And then sometimes you can reach people who start thinking differently. One of the most interesting experiences in being in government, being in the GNU, is that when I start speaking about growth and competitiveness and unclogging the arteries, as I've said, the people who I tend to get the most support from, this astounds me, are the SACP members. I would never have thought that, but in government, the younger SACP members seem to accept, maybe it's ideological that they see capitalism as a stage of development and so on in their own worldview. I don't know. I haven't asked them for the specifics, but I tend to get more support from that crowd. So surprisingly, adapting your language and not using common lexicon and things that come out of IMF documents and just carefully listening to the words of your opponents and framing it in those terms somehow gets through to them sometimes.
That requires wisdom. I recall reading Peter Brown. Anybody who's been to Peter Maritzburg will know as you go in this Peter Brown Road. You might not know who Peter Brown was, but he was a great South African, a leader of the Liberal Party, banned for many years, and it's worth going and reading about him. But Michael Carter's biography of Peter Brown is the title is Opening Men's Eyes, and that what Peter Brown stood for, and I think any self-respecting journalist should be as well, is that you don't poke people's eyes out, you try to open them. And I guess that's, in a way, what you have to do every day.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent most of my career arguing and fighting with these folk across the floor of parliament and legislatures and councils and in constituencies and in public meetings and so on. And it's very gratifying to be able to say to someone you're completely useless and have no idea what you're doing. Trust me, it's very emotionally gratifying to do so. But it doesn't deliver results. I've done this for a very long time, and it's actually very... And let's be honest, they make it easy. They do make it exceptionally easy to attack and to pick apart, because the arguments are frequently simplistic and trapped in 1960s ideology. But in government, you have to deliver results. Now, my job is not frontline facing. It's part of deep in policy. And thankfully, at the Treasury, we've got a very capable economic policy team who I can work with. And the key thing is, once you've got the policy work, you've done the modeling, you've got the econometrics sorted, you then need to figure out the game plan and how you're going to get as many people to agree as possible to begin to deliver the results, the kind of things that France was speaking about earlier. Because if we don't, if GDP per capita continues to fall, we don't get growth to at least 1.6%, then we are creating the toxic mix by which you could have more instances like July 2021 and so on, where frustration boils over.
Andre Durante yesterday had some very interesting things to say about Eskom, as you can imagine. France continued with it, and you've now picked up on the same theme. I'd like you to maybe take their two points. The one that Andre was saying was, hang on, we haven't got load shedding because we've got 6 gigs that is being produced by the private sector. And secondly, France saying, just burn the coal. Now, Rob Herzog and I were at the ARC conference in February this year, where there was a very strong message coming through. The Chinese are laughing at the West. The West is sitting here, especially the UK, not burning coal, cutting back their economy, pushing up their energy prices, and their economy is in a lot of trouble. The Chinese are continuing to burn coal as they did in the past, and their economy was, relatively speaking, was growing. We in South Africa seem to be at a bit of a strange point here. Would you pick up on what Franz said about burn the coal? Let's just use our advantage, or is that not politically correct?
The entire structure of our electricity network is built around transmitting electricity from the north of the country, where we've got coal-fired power plants and mines, to the rest of the country. That's the transmission infrastructure. There's no getting around that. A lot of the renewable energy that is produced goes to waste, not because the companies are inefficient or so on, but because we just don't have the transmission infrastructure. One of the reasons why the car power ship, bringing those Turkish ships across and docking them, wouldn't have worked is because what are you going to plug it into? You need to get it onto a national grid. And so these things are not the solution for as long as you've got this transmission problem. So you've got to do two things at once. You've got to install transmission infrastructure to get new generating capacity onto the system, which I'm source agnostic. I don't actually care whether it's nuclear or coal or renewables, whatever. We need energy. Energy availability and energy supply tracks growth, the direct correlation. So whatever is cheapest and quickest and easiest, build it and get it onto the grid. You've got to be pragmatic about these things. Right now, because of Chinese overproduction, there is a lot of solar available very cheaply. So plug it in and augment your supply. The challenge with our coal-fired power stations is that they're all old, leaky, problematic, falling apart, badly engineered now because they're well past their life cycle. So keep burning the coal for as long as you can. But when these plants break down, know that there's very few easy fixes. And so we've got to do two things at once, burn the coal, but we've also got to install the transmission infrastructure so that we are not dependent on one kind of source when these things begin to break.
When I was a young journalist, I remember Anglo-American was giving over its mines reluctantly, the old mines, to various players in the private sector, including a really fascinating guy from Cyprus called Lucas Peroulis. And Lucas Peroulis took these old mines, Consmoda and many others, and he turned them into gold mines, because they were gold mines, but he was able to have a different approach to them. Is that not something that the DA, being a supporter of the spirit of free enterprise, should be suggesting, that you can take these old power plants, give them to the private sector, and you may be pleasantly surprised at what they do with them?
Yeah. Look, the DA's policy is to have a horizontally unbundled private competitive generating market, i.e. that there shouldn't be a state-run monopoly or state ownership of generating capacity at all. That what you can, and there are lots of ways you can do this, but even if you handed these power stations over to the private sector, the single biggest challenge here is that they're 15, 20 years in some cases past their design life. And there's no amount of engineering that can solve that some of these problems in these stations. So you need a build program with the private sector. So you can hand them over, but you need new build. You need new capacity.
Do you know Kelvin?
Yes.
Do you know that Tsepo Malelwe, who's the only other shareholder in BizNews, owns... They own Kelvin, they operate Kelvin, and they've been operating it very efficiently, and that's like one of the oldest power stations. My suggestion really is, yeah, that I hear what you say, but the private sector does surprise you when, as Tsepo and his team have done at Kelvin.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big fan of the private sector, making sure that the private sector runs things. But we need a private sector build program for new capacity. If it's new clean coal, and we come from the French, the Chinese, domestic, I don't know, same source agnostic. But even with a power station like Kelvin, it is very old. Let me put it this way. Even if we fix everything, we still don't have enough megawatts to fuel growth. You need more energy. And energy needs to be able to supply the base for growth. and you need stability of supply. So you need the competitive market, multiple players. Otherwise, you're going to be trapped in the situation where you have between 10 and 33% electricity crisis increases year after year.
Okay, so now you've given us the solution. Francis said, well, just don't tax the investment. If you're trying to get that done and you tax your investment with 30%, it ain't going to happen. My half of the conversation with you, I'm now moving with your other hat. So take your Deputy Finance Minister hat off. Talk to me about DA strategy. Where are you guys at the moment, given the fact that all of the polls are telling us that the DA is doing a heck of a lot better than its major rival? Has the GNU worked for you?
So I have been involved in running election campaigns for the party for a very long time. And one of the big challenges is that while there's a significant chunk of ANC voters, particularly middle-class ANC voters, whose second-choice party is the DA, they couldn't bring themselves to vote for the DA for a variety of reasons. And it was a lot of the ANC scare tactics, that if the DA came into national government, social grants would disappear, go back to the good old days and pre-94 and those sorts of things. Well, now the party's in national government, and it makes it very difficult for the ANC to run those attacks on us. Firstly, because the bad things haven't happened that particular market feared. But secondly, it has no credibility. How can you govern with these people if they are this evil group of people who want to go back to pre-94? And so in that sense, it's detoxified our brand amongst a whole lot of voters. So I think when you look at the polls and the market research and so on, it's still a long way to an election. A poll is a snapshot in time. But what it does show is that the biggest weapon that was frequently brandished against us can't easily be weaponized anymore. And so a whole new series of attacks would have to be devised. And while a week is long term in politics, it's not that much time left to the local government elections. It's potentially potentially a year away now. That it would be very, very difficult to run those same attacks. So we can put up, hypothetically, a former mayor of Cape Town in the city of Johannesburg if we were to do so, and it would be very, very difficult to run those same attacks.
Your polling is brilliant. And there's, from Greg and from the conversations we've had, you're just so close to the mark. I know that France runs the Social Research Foundation. They're pretty good as well with Gareth and so on. But what is your polling telling you now about Helen standing in Johannesburg?
So I'm very careful about this because polling reports directly to me, and I work very closely with the team, and I am very careful to not leak polling data. What I can say is that I think that if we had the right candidate in Johannesburg, it would be a game changer, and that in so many ways, the people of Johannesburg are so tired of what they see as the total collapse of the city. And it is in a death spiral. A lot of its services are in a total death spiral. That someone that is credible and has a track record, regardless of their race or their age, provided that they have the capacity would make a lot of voters stand up, pay attention, and vote as pragmatically as they can to fix the decay around them.
A game changer, meaning over 50%?
So the reality of proportional representation is that it's very rare that proportional representation produces majorities anywhere in the world. It lends itself to fragmentation. And I think we've got to come to terms with the fact that 50% plus one, while is a nice political slogan, is not how proportional representation works. And so for as long as we have proportional representation, and I am a big fan of proportional representation, I don't think 50% plus one is realistic in many places. But I think that if you can be the largest party by a significant margin, when I say large, but I mean 10, 15, 20 points bigger than the second largest party, then you are in the driving seat, as the ANC has shown us nationally and how they manage the GNU. There's nothing to stop a party that gets to those numbers in the cities from inverting the situation and applying their same strategy to them.
Tell us about the other major metros, Tshwane, Ekurhuleni, and Durban and PE.
I mean, let's start with Durban. So the reason why there's so much news coverage and sudden concern about the failure of local government is because every single major journalist in the country lives in Johannesburg and writes about Johannesburg and cares deeply about Johannesburg. The institutional decay at local government has been going on for 15 years. And in places like Lichtenberg, where Clover packed up because they couldn't get water and moved to Mudval, I believe, and so on, shows you that this has been a long time coming. And that kind of decay has existed in many places. Durban is a prime example. And water tanker mafias have set in. And so in large swathes of Durban, particularly across the Indian communities out there, there are water tankers providing water because every time the infrastructure gets fixed, the water tanker mafia goes and breaks it down. In Hammond's Kraal, there's been the water tanker mafia situation. So the mafia state is set into these places. And the decay is in many ways similar, in many places worse than Johannesburg. It just doesn't get written about because none of the mainstream press live in those areas. And so all of the major metros are in play because they all have similar problems to Johannesburg. Of course, Cape Town being the one that's not. But the rest of the metros are in play. So Durban is very much in play. Durban's going to be interesting because you will have a very large DA, you'll have a very large MK, and then who is the third party and what percentage do they get? Could it be the IFP? Could it be the ANC? That remains to be seen in the course of an election. And Durban's also interesting because it's run on an executive committee system, not a mayoral committee system. So no matter what happens, the council will have an executive committee in proportion to the voting share. And so hypothetically, if the DA gets 40%, there's four seats. The MK gets 40%, there's four seats. And then the IFP could get one, the ANC could get one, and then you've got to figure out how to run the municipality with every vote not being decided by, every decision not being decided by a mayor, but by that executive committee. So that will be an interesting experience in governance. And so let no one, I see lots of commentators on saying, we can solve this coalition madness by moving to the EXCO system. It's not the solution. In the other municipalities, all run on a mayoral committee system, coalitions are going to be everything, and functional coalitions are going to be important. And that's why I say it's very, very important in these places, all of them, that the DA is the largest party by some significant margin, so that we can get a functional coalition together rather than trying to run 12 or 13 party coalitions that we have in the past, where you're subject to the whims of one or other player who trades you off against each other with the ANC until they can get the best deal.
You're sitting in the Western Cape, where the opposition party here, certainly from what we understand, is the Patriotic Alliance. Are you seeing that the participation of its leader, Gayton McKenzie, in cabinet has been a positive, or has it been a bit of a shooting star?
So invariably, whenever a new government comes in and there's a sense of change, every single person in the, particularly all the new people, gets a new shiny sort of gloss of coat on them. And they look good to the electorates, and they look like they are able to do things better or differently than their predecessors. Every time there's a democratic change of government, when you look at the optimism, people are a lot more optimistic. And then slowly over time, the reality of government, of governing, sets in, and people begin to change their views. So I think Gayton is very much still in that honeymoon period, with a lot of positive publicity in the initial months. And the PA is very much an interesting party. But when I look at the by-elections, and data's everything, so it's easy to just look at, oh, PA wins this ward and that ward. When you look at the raw votes, the PA is doing something interesting, because particularly in the Western Cape, when you look at the by-elections, in many cases, we're getting more votes than we did in the general election. But the ANC's voter base has collapsed into the PA. That is very clear. And people who have stopped voting, much like the Donald Trump effect, have started voting for the PA. So those are two interesting things. And you see this in the actual election result in the Western Cape. In 2019, the DA got 55% on the provincial ballot in the Western Cape, and the ANC got 29%. In 2024, the DA got 55%, despite all of the talk in the run-up, Gayton McKenzie as the premier candidate for the Western Cape and so on. And the ANC got 19% and the PA got 8%. So the sort of UDF historic ANC voter base has definitely migrated into the PA and out of that to that column as well. It has hurt the DA. I'd say it's taken 5 to 8% of our vote in that market. But the biggest loser there has been the ANC up to now. So it remains to be seen what happens in the municipals. But certainly when we look at the raw vote numbers, it's an interesting phenomenon.
You got lots of questions, Ashur. Rob Herzog. Jeez, Rob, you're participating, eh? You're the Helen Zille of this conference, yeah. As it is so blatantly obvious to us what is going wrong, why and how to fix it, do the ANC ministers acknowledge this or not? Are they persuadable or are they locked into the ideological rigidity at all costs, or are they just stupid?
So I think it's important not to see the ANC as a single entity, despite the fact that it's a 39.76% party. It's not a 40% party. Must be clear about that. In fact, someone recently said to me, a very senior person in government said, I need to take this decision before they tell me about the elective conference of a 39% party, which is an interesting phenomenon and the mindset change amongst civil servants. So in the ANC, you've got a couple of things, and this reflects in the executive as well, and how I understand them and work around them or with them. You've got a group of pragmatists who want to rescue the situation. Very small, but they're there. That's one part of the ANC. Then you've got a group of rural traditionalists, and hence and as the rural voter base has become important to the ANC as they've led in the metros, they have a lot of power. Hence Jacob Zuma's Premier League, if you recall, with Ace Magashule and those guys. It's another group. You've got the old unionists. You've got the old communists and the young communists, and they have very different worldviews. You've got the straight-up criminals who just want to steal everything in sight, and you've got... I mean, So the answer to that question is there are people who get it and want to do the right thing. And that's why on logistics, you're seeing the opening up and the private sector coming in, because you've got someone there who wants to do the right thing, for example, and so on. And energy, you're beginning to see some movement and that kind of thing as well. On local governments, well, that's between the IFP now and us, so it's different. But you're beginning to see some movement there as well. So it really does depend on which faction they fall in, where they are, and what their motivations are as well. So it's not as simple as basically all of the above.
He also wants to know if there's any brain in the ANC Brains Trust, and if there's even a brain trust in the ANC, and who are they?
So, I mean, again, I'm not a member of the ANC, so I never have been. I can't comment on the Brains Trust. I have met people in the ANC I would much rather not know. I have met people in the ANC who I just wonder, what are you still doing in the ANC? It's 2025. The problem with the ANC is even if there was a Brains Trust, even if the Brains Trust existed, they wouldn't be able to exert influence over the party the way the DA Brains Trust is able to, because of the rife factionalism and the fact that the party can never take a decision. And so they keep putting things off. And so it's almost irrelevant whether or not there's a Brains Trust in the ANC because of the structural problems in that party. And I want you to think about the structural problems of the ANC like this. So when you go to an elective conference in the DA, we weight our delegates to a conference based on the vote share of the municipal ward they're from. So if you're in an urban ward, you'll get 4 delegates to a conference. If you're a rural ward, you'll get 1, because in an urban ward, there are 15,000 registered voters. In a rural ward in Kuruman, there's 500 registered voters. In the ANC, it doesn't matter whether you're in Soweto or you are in Kuruman. The branch gets the same representation. There are inherently more rural wards with smaller populations, which means that you've also got this rural capture problem at a conference, which makes it very expensive. And so it's almost impossible to control, because they're not set up for internally, democratically. For a modern country where 70% of the population lives in 13 major metros and secondary cities. And so that entire system is skewed and lends itself to almost the zonification of the ANC.
R.W. Johnson says it's not an elective conference, it's an auction. And that seems to suggest, if you're coming from Kuruman, where this is your golden ring opportunity, are you going to turn down 100,000 rand? Probably not. Okay, James Rothman asks, Treasury recently published a report on the effectiveness of renewable energy tax incentives. You said that energy competitiveness is critical for economic growth. What is Treasury's current view on these incentives, and can businesses expect them to continue in the medium term?
So, I mean, we're in a sort of policy close-up period ahead of the MTBPS, so I'd be getting into a lot of trouble to comment on what you can expect in the media in the MTBPS or ahead of tax policy. Treasury is a very structured way of doing things. I think that the incentives for embedded generation has worked very clearly, and it has been the single biggest improvement in generating capacity in the country. And so I would certainly want it to continue for as long as we can do it in a fiscally sustainable manner, firstly. And secondly, what needs to expand is we need to get proper wheeling systems into municipalities that people with surplus supply from their factories, their businesses, their homes can wheel it onto the grid and sell it back to the municipalities as quickly as they can so that we can maximize the amount of energy availability. So that would be my take on that.
Would you go to bat for 12J or for 12EB and trying to get the private sector to not put all of their private individuals, not to put their excess funds offshore, but to go into a local investment? We desperately need it, as Franz told us.
Yeah, so I like 12J. I think it's a great pity that we don't have it anymore. But 12J was a useful thing for the longest time. When I was fresh out of university and started my first job, I mean, one of the things you do is you start saving money. You should start saving money. And so 12J was a nice way to sort of, you know, save. So I like
it. But Treasury said it didn't work.
Yes, Treasury did say it didn't work. I have a different view. And I mean, and you asked me to speak with my DA hat on, so I'm speaking with my DA hat on, not my Treasury hat. I have a different view. I think that every incentive you can in a country with very low savings to help people maximize their savings and have a reason to invest rather than consume, because consumption is very high in the South African economy. The government loves to consume. Consumers spend a lot of money on instant gratification and so on. Economies that are successful globally focus household, government, business expenditure on investment and not consumption. And so anything that you can do to incentivize investment rather than consumption should be maximized. And we need to better educate people about these things. I think one of the reasons 12J didn't work was because not enough people knew about it and knew about the incentive and so on. Much like we don't, the tax-free savings account is another great system. You speak about local investment and so on. But the tax-free savings account system, again, not enough people, not enough consumers are aware of this vehicle to build savings, deposit 3,000 rand a month for 15 years, leave it alone, and in 25 years' time, you'll have 2.5 million rand in the bank. You know, that kind of thing. People don't know that. And the more we can do to educate people about that and build a culture of savings, the better it will be, the better outcomes we'll get economically in the long run. So I'm a firm believer that expenditure, whether household, business, if you're going to choose between consumption and investments, always choose investments. And so the tax system, in my view, should always reflect that.
12J is something that the BizNews tribe was starting to get into when it was then abolished. And it had taken a heck of a long time to build to that, the momentum to that point. But more strength to your ability to open eyes on that one too. Denver Firmage says, seeing as the ANC only won 39% of the vote, is there any way the DA can leverage their position by voting against any budget allocation to a bad ANC policy like NHI?
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing because we obviously voted against the 0.5% VAT budget 2.0. Everyone remembers that. And the ANC found a back door through other minor all the small parties and so on. And so I think that even in this environment, the problem that we have is that you've got parties that are just desperate to get themselves in the cabinet seats at this stage. But we did make that clear. There was another incident in Parliament recently where boards need to be appointed. I think it might have been small business, but it could be corrected. And because we were going to vote against, at that moment, the DA and the Freedom Front Plus were going to vote against the chief whip of the ANC withdrew the item just as they were going to start to vote. And so you do see this kind of exact kind of leverage. The thing about the NHI is that while it has been signed into law, it hasn't been promulgated, thank heavens. And you know, as long as it's not promulgated, that is that. But the litigation is going to solve the NHI problem. And so the DA invests tremendously into litigation. Similarly, in the Expropriation Act, you know, I happen to be Helen Zille's deputy in the party. And so we work a lot in the litigation to try to solve these things. So you've got to find every avenue. And Parliament is the avenue for some things, new things that you don't want. But things have already been signed into law. Your solution is litigation. If it hasn't followed process, if it is irrational, if you can find the angle. So it really does depend on which bad idea you're fighting, the angle of attack and the strategy.
Balkanization or unitary state?
Well, I'm a federalist, so federal state. Neither of the above. My view is that if we can give the provinces and local government more power and reduce the amount of power in the national government, that would solve a lot of the problems. Because the objective of federalism is that you have laboratories of policy. So instead of having BE nationally, why didn't you just try it there? Why didn't you try something else there? And so I think that federalism is the solution to a lot of these things. And that's why federal states tend to produce better outcomes, because the laboratories of democracy test policies. Different people elect. Even in India, despite the fact that it's defined as a unitary state, it's remarkably federal, far more than ours. And so in the south, you've got a state run by communists that have great health care. In the north, you have states that are really pro-business and have reliable energy 24/7. And then people can choose, and people can vote, of course, at the ballot box, but also with their feet as to which policies they prefer to live under.
Yeah, I'm so grateful to hear that, because if we were to lose the Springboks and you had a shark supporter having to support the Stormers, could be a real conflict of interest there. Peter Schroeder asks, is it surprising that no one is raising law and order in the top fundamentals to fix the arrest and incarceration of a dishonest government official in Singapore? Kickstarted the turnaround in this now thriving country. Why is this not a critical requirement for South Africa?
It actually is the critical requirement. I focused my remarks on the structural constraints, because those are the things that I at least have with the economic policy team at the Treasury and so on, some influence over. In the end, with municipalities, the intergovernmental fiscal relations team. So I focus on what's in my domain of control. But the truth is that at the base of, if you go to think of building an economy as a pyramid. At the top, you can have factors, your top factors of competitiveness, like industrial master plans. You can have the, as Franz mentioned, the cannabis master plan and whatever at the top. But if the blocks below that don't work, this thing never takes off. At the base, you need two things to get an economy moving. You need the rule of law, so firmly entrenched judicial review, criminal justice system, and you need law and order. Once you've got that functional, then you need your network industries to function as well. Electricity, water, utilities, communications, and those sorts of things. And then you need education once those things are working. And then you need good economic policy. And then you can have industrial policy at the end. Not that I'm a firm believer in industrial policy. I think that if you create the environment, things happen naturally. So I'm not a supporter of industrial policy. But at the base of all of this is the rule of law and law of order. And for as long as those things don't function, the rest of your economy cannot actually begin to build. Nobody's going to put fixed capex into a place where your investment will likely be stolen because it's physically removed out of the ground and sold for scrap metal and those sorts of things. So that is at the base of building any economy. And it's the key factor of competitiveness. If you don't, so you can have, for example, China doesn't have many factors of competitiveness that you'd think about anymore. Aging population and those sorts of things. But it does have rule of law, but it's got law and order. And that's critical, because if you go and invest in China, you know that your assets are not going to be stolen or stripped the scrap metal and those sorts of things. In South Africa, we don't have that. And if we don't fix that, it does make the investment case very, very difficult. I frequently meet with a lot of investors, institutional investors, bond market investors, and so on. And the one thing that comes up that they do speak about a lot is crime. Say, solve your crime problem and you've solved 30% of your problems.
So you've got a minute left. A message of hope?
Look, I've lived under one party rule my entire life until 2024. I was born in 88, and I don't remember much of that time, but it was the National Party until 94, and then the ANC. One party dominance is all I've ever known. The fact that we don't know that anymore suddenly, it slowly rose in all at once, means that there's tremendous opportunities in the country politically to deliver change. And so, of course, every vote matters and so on, but the result was inevitable. The ANC was always going to win. Now anybody can be the biggest party, and it's up to the voters to decide who that biggest party is as our politics evolves. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in spite of all of our problems, we are still the largest, most industrialized economy on the continent. And again, speaking to investors, basically, they just say to me, fix these four or five things and the money will flow. So we've just got to start doing more and more fixing those four or five things. I've outlined three of them. Crime is the fourth. Fix those things, and South Africa can accelerate very, very quickly. So the fundamentals are in place for South Africa to be a great place. It's there. It just needs to be unlocked. And if we can just make the right voting decisions, the right political decisions, and then get the right economic decisions, I think that we can have another two decades of prosperity without too much trauma or drama, even in this complicated global environment.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.